Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and we're talking to the Nature Guy. Welcome, Dr. Adkins.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, Dr. Adkins, we're on your turf.
That's right.
Your turf is the Camp Asabo in Grayling, Michigan, and we are in the Strong Tower Radio ASI Lake Union Studio, and courtesy of also Camp Asabo hosting us here. We really thank Camp Asabo. Gives us an opportunity to talk to Dr. Adkins, but many other people, because this is kind of a conference center where guest speakers are often found. So we're looking forward to it. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, we're looking at your nature again, and we just want to thank you for the opportunity to sojourn with Dr. Gordon Adkins, and he shares tips and the wonders of your creation. Be with us today and be with our listeners and help us to have greater appreciation of our Maker. Amen. Dr. Adkins, what's our subject today?
Well, today I'd like to talk about fish migration. In the past episodes, we've focused on birds, and I didn't want to leave the fish out of the story because they're an important one.
And we're in the Great Lakes State, and there's a lot of water around us.
That's correct. There's a large number of fish in our Great Lakes States, and Michigan is home to many of them. And so this is happening in every body of water just about in Michigan. There's fish, and they're busy sometimes, and they're active.
Very good. Well, we're going to talk about fish migration. So when we think of fish, there's lake fish, and then there's the big lake fish, but there's also river species. How are they all different?
Well, different species live in different habitats, just like other organisms. So they have their favorite spots. Certain fish are more likely to be found in the deeper lakes and others in streams and rivers and so forth. So that's a starting point. But then in certain parts of their biology and their life cycle, they will move from those areas to other areas. And that's what we call migration.
Very good. Let me take this a little further. Do all fish migrate?
No. Many fish do migrate, and others that don't, even though they may not sort of officially migrate, moving long distances in a particular direction and so forth, they may move within their habitat as the environmental conditions change. So that's not sort of not technically migration, but they'll move to where they need to be, but not at a great distance.
Now, you mentioned habitat. Does habitat determine the fish, or the fish determine the habitat?
Well, like in all living things, both. But fish do require particular environmental conditions. Many fish are quite sensitive to the temperature. And so temperature changes, seasonal temperature changes, cause some fish to move. Of course, some fish also, the trout, for example, need high oxygen levels. So you're going to find them in colder water because colder water.
And moving water too, right?
Well, moving water will add oxygen into the water, the mixing and so forth that goes on. So it keeps the oxygen levels high. So there are specific environmental things that some fish must seek out in order to survive.
Now, when people think about fish migration, they think about these long distances. Tell us the fabric of those big migrations, those epic.
Right. Most of the fish migration that people are aware of originate from studies out in the West Coast. So the salmon migrations, they spend years in the ocean and maybe travel several thousand miles in the ocean in large circles. And then they come back to their habitat and will swim upstream, the many streams coming from or leading into the Pacific up into the mountains. And those, you know, are against all odds in terms of, you know, waterfalls and currents and predators and grizzly bears and so forth. So those are spectacular 1,000-mile migrations of the Pacific salmon.
And, you know, people can think of grizzly bears there, and there's fish all around him, and he just swipes one and or just grabs it with their jaws and runs off with it.
Those are spectacular migrations that are very seasonal, and you might go to that location and see nothing one day, and then just a few days later, all of this happens. So they are spectacular. They are long. In Michigan, in the Great Lakes areas, they're not as spectacular, I suppose, in terms of the duration and distances. But migration is spectacular even over a short distance. The changes that take place biologically in the fish, the whole reproductive cycles, the effects on the environment and the effects on people. So it's not as many miles, but it's still very impactful here in the Great Lakes.
So when do these fish, migrate, and why do they migrate?
So most fish, and again, we're being general here, most fish, the migration is in the fall when the water temperatures start to drop. For many species also, the day length, the shorter day length that we even detect can be the trigger for migration.
Now, are these fish migrating in, or are they migrating out?
Well, it depends. There are so many different species of fish that it's hard to answer that. But many fish will, when the water temperatures start to drop, the reason, let's go to that first, the reason for doing this migration is to move to suitable spawning grounds. And so, depending on the species of fish, what is needed for good development of the eggs once they're laid and fertilized, that's where they're going. They're trying to go somewhere where the eggs will have the best possibility for survival. And so, really, what's going on is they've spent the summer in a good spot for feeding. Then they need to move to a good spot to lay their eggs so that the eggs have a good possibility of surviving, hatching, and going on. So it depends very much on the species. In a lot of cases, that is moving from the lakes to rivers or moving from one part of a river to another part of a river, depending again on the species and what that species needs for their eggs.
So how far do they migrate?
Well, instead of the thousands of miles in the Pacific story...
They don't have as much space, huh?
Well, they don't have as big of an ocean. But traveling several hundred miles is not unheard of. From their summer feeding areas to their spawning grounds, several hundred miles.
I think about the Great Lakes. I think of Lake Michigan. They go deeper? Do they go further north, further south? Some general trends.
Right. Well, so some of the fish in the lakes will move from deeper, colder parts to shallower, warmer parts of the lake because that's better for the eggs. Again, depending on the species, because some require really cold water, like like trout in a river. But many of the Great Lakes fish will not migrate to a river, but just to a shallower, warmer spot in the lake.
So, how do they know when they've got there?
Well, I suppose that's a great mystery. You can't have a conversation with a fish to ask it that question, but there's clearly in those fish, particularly that travel distances, they're not just going to a shallower part of the lake, but they're really going somewhere up a river to a particular spot. They use their sense of smell to get right to their location. In many species, the salmon, particularly the right to the very little bend, the very little same gravel patch that they hatched out in themselves. And so at some point they've gone, you know, they hatch, the little ones would hatch, have traveled to a large lake, like one of the Great Lakes. In the West, they would travel down the rivers and spend years out in the Pacific Ocean. But either way, they'll end up having to come back to the same spot. And the sense of smell is really important.
Now, I'm confused. Doesn't seem like they have much of a nose. How do they smell?
They do have nostrils that take in water and actually olfaction, the sense of olfaction, works best in a moist or wet surface. So they're set up, seeing that they're living in water, to smell things better than we do. And you know that our nose, the air going in, the particles in the air that we're smelling actually have to dissolve in the moisture, the mucous membranes of our nose in order for us to be able to detect that. For the fish, the odor's in the water already, so it just has to attach to the receptors and they can smell.
And it's already moist.
Right, exactly. Let me
ask you that question. So they've got the smell, but you didn't say anything about taste.
Right. I'm not really sure about how much fish taste. They'll eat all sorts of things, and sometimes you see them spit it out. But that's actually more the sense of touch. If things are sharp or, you know, they realize it's not the right thing, they'll spit it out. And fishermen know that all too well, that if it doesn't feel like the right thing, it'll often get spit out. So the sense of smell is used for that very local, like, find the spot. And the problem there is when we disrupt the environment, build a bridge, for example, on a river, we have to be very careful that we don't allow sediment to flow down the river, because that's going to change the odor.
Really?
And then really mess that up for the fish.
I thought that just got their gills all gummed up.
Well, there's how much oxygen you can breathe in mucky water is another issue, but it does change the smell of an area. And so an area that's been highly constructed and modified can then sort of mess up the match. The fish are trying to match the odor that they're detecting with the odor in their memory. And if that's been obliterated, it's going to be problematic.
How has fish research developed over the year? You talked about in birds, you use certain species because the transmitters were so heavy. So it was the bigger birds.
They were studied first because of the bulkiness of the material. Now that we've got computer chips, we can study smaller ones too.
So how do you study fish?
Well, the fish studies, particularly the ones out in the West, there's all sorts of ways. Some simple things are just putting tags on the fins that mark the fish. And then you come back 5 years later when the fish are returning and, you know, see who's got there, follow some of them. Then, of course, they were able to transmit and with transmitters and underwater transmitters, and you can sort of do the same thing. You can also do echolocation through the water to see the fish underwater, to visualize them and look at sort of mass movement of fish, not just individuals. So there's a lot of different options. But in those studies, that brought up another feature that, particularly for the long-distance migrants, it's not just the sense of smell, but they're also using the magnetic magnetic compass, detecting the geomagnetic force over the Earth, just like birds do.
Yeah.
And one of the simplest experiments was done with fish that would catch salmon and put them in large buckets at different places along the meandering river. So, you know, where the river's maybe going north, they would look at the orientation of the fish in the bucket on the shore right there. And so there's no odor to follow. There's no odor trail. But the fish were all oriented north. You take the bucket of fish and go to a different part of the river that's maybe going east now, and the fish would line up in the bucket going east.
Wow.
So they have a sort of a memory map of the geomagnetic field that they swam downstream when they were little guys, and now coming back up, they match that. And then as they get closer and closer, the chemical signals and olfaction take over, and they can get right to the very little bend in the creek with the right little bunch of rocks that they were, their eggs were, that they hatched out in when they were little.
Amazing. So while they're doing all this, do they eat the same food the whole time?
No, fish will often change their diet when they start the migration. And again, particularly our Great Lakes fish, they'll switch to a fattier diet as the cold is coming. So that's one thing, as well as the fatty diet is what's needed for the production of large amount of eggs. So that does switch. Now, there are some species that, especially in the West, that quit eating during the migration. They won't eat.
Single focus.
Get up there, lay their eggs, fertilize the eggs if you're the male fish, and then they die. And so it's one migration, and there's, I guess, no need to eat when in a few weeks you're going to die anyway. So the fish here in Michigan don't do that, and so they do switch their diet, continue to eat, and in fact eat quite a bit during that time in order to produce the eggs, and then have enough nutrition left over to survive another year.
With all this migrating taking place, does it affect the environment, the biology?
Yes. And this has been very interesting. I kind of couldn't believe it at first, but that's just the narrow-mindedness of my own thinking. But particularly the fish in the West, if we can go back out to the Pacific coast, the salmon that have spent 4 or 5 years swimming around the Pacific Ocean, growing and ingesting nutrients, including nitrogen, which all things need to live. These fish then swim inland for several hundred miles, maybe even close to 1,000 miles maximum for some. And if they, lay their eggs and die or get caught by grizzly bears, as we talked about earlier, then the nutrients of that fish land up on land. Some of the studies, a significant percentage of the nitrogen that's available for trees and other animals on land can be traced back to the fish, back to the oceans where the fish came from.
And I assume that the closer you are to the water source, the greater the nitrogen?
Correct. There's more, you're going to have more dead fish on shore and not too far from shore. But, eagles and osprey and even bears will carry food a distance, and then of course the droppings of these animals that ate the fish contain that nitrogen, so they may have wandered back into the forest quite a bit.
So you have a dead tree that they like to perch on, but they eat and they drop and so on and so forth. So the vegetation under there is probably well nitrated.
Right. A lot of the plants growing within several hundred miles of the Pacific coast rely on the nitrogen from the ocean.
Amazing.
As nutrition there. So I am not aware of similar studies done in the Great Lakes Basin, but the same thing happens. Fish live in the lake, move upstream. We don't have grizzly bears. Black bears don't catch as many fish, but our eagles and osprey and so forth. There is distribution of the nitrogen nutrient from the lake that lands up helping to grow our pine trees in Michigan.
Wow. And just thinking about it, if it's a large spawning, there would be a lot of dead fish.
Right. The nutrient cycling, as we call it in ecology, depends on the year, and that depends on the temperature and food availability and lots of things. So not every year has the same run and the same impact on the environment as other years.
How does fish migrations affect human behavior?
Well, fishing in Michigan is a major tourist attraction.
It changes behavior.
It does. There are a lot of people that come to Michigan for fishing, particularly the salmon and steelhead during migrations. Those are not just sort of cultural, historical movements of people.
It's recreational sport.
It is. There's a lot of people today, even though they may not need the fish to survive through the winter like the indigenous species, indigenous humans did, these species of fish are a major attraction to mankind currently.
So there's an economic impact.
Well, yes, and then there is fishing. Besides the sports fishing, there is the sort of the industrial fishing, that is time to fish movements and migration as well. And so fall and winter are really important sort of fishing industry times.
And some of these become foodstuffs, but some of them are the parts of the fish are not marketable for human food, but they come for other industries.
Pet foods and other animals.
And fertilizers.
And fertilizers too, yes. So there's a broad impact. We think of a fish swimming upstream as doing it for himself, by himself, but there's, like everything in ecology, there's so much interconnectedness. It's remarkable to see how far-reaching the impacts are.
And literally, you know, the hotel industry, the restaurant industry, of tourists,
yes.
and fishers.
Absolutely. The economic impact of the fish in the Great Lakes area is huge for these states.
There's a lot of speculation, a lot of controversy over climate change and impact, what is the feelings and thoughts along these ways?
Well, here in Michigan, we actually have the potential for really studying this well.
Because we have a closed ecosystem?
No, less so than, say, an ocean system.
Okay.
That's true. But fish biology has been a major emphasis of study in Michigan for over 75 years. We have such a
longitudinal.
Yeah, we have really good baseline data,
yeah,
of what was going on 75 years ago up to the present. And as we continue that in the future.
We've had two great conversations with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. And
right.
It's been fun.
Yes. That's been a big part of
driving factor
of what we know about fish in Michigan. And so as we continue to progress through and measure climate change, we have good background data to work with, and so we'll be able to make a stronger case for what's happening than, say, just, well, I think climate change beginning is having effect on, you know, this species, but if you don't know what it was like before, it's really hard to have that conversation. So the huge fish biology studies that have gone on for so long are a big help. The biggest thing is water temperature. As we mentioned, many fish have very specific water temperature requirements. And so if climate change causes these long-term changes or even short-term changes that are severe in water temperature, then we're going to see the effects on the fish.
Let's look at the five species of salmon that are in the Great Lakes. How many of them are native and how many of them are been planted?
All right. Well, let's go through them one at a time. The Chinook salmon, which is also known as the king salmon in some local areas, they're the largest of the salmon, and they can weigh up to 50 pounds. So
that's hefty.
That's a significant fish when you catch one. And these typically migrate from the Great Lakes both spring and fall. So there's sort of two time windows there.
And are these native?
Yes.
Okay.
The coho salmon are smaller than the Chinook. Maybe they weigh 15 pounds, but they're very, very strong fighters, so anglers really prize catching a coho. And they migrate to the Great Lakes in the fall, so again, one of these fall species.
Now, I see you put in the description acrobatic fighting ability.
They
jump out of the water.
They're one of those ones that jump and move a lot. When you catch one, you're going to know you've got something that's trying to get away, and so that's becomes, I guess, a bigger challenge to the fishermen.
Now, what about this pink salmon?
Pink salmon, they're the smallest of the salmon species found in Michigan. They maybe maximum weigh only about 5 pounds. But they're not very common in Michigan like the previous two that we've talked about. And their migration patterns, interestingly, are less predictable. I don't know if that's just because there's not as many and we haven't, you know, really figured it out yet. For some reason, they tend to migrate into Michigan's Great Lakes waters on the odd numbered year. So it's every other year on the odd year. So I'm not sure why, but it's every other year. And even within that, it's not so predictable.
What about the Atlantic salmon?
So the Atlantic salmon are not native to Michigan, but you can find them in some of the rivers and streams where they've been stocked there for recreational fishing. They're about the same size as the coho salmon, but they're also known for their aggressive feeding and fighting behavior. Atlantic salmon, again, not normally here, but we've stocked them in the waters of Michigan.
And salmon number five, the sockeye salmon.
Yeah, the sockeye salmon, also not commonly found in Michigan. They're not native to the Great Lakes. These are the ones typically found in the Pacific Ocean, some of the research we've been talking about. And so they're seldom found in Michigan, but they have been released in some places, so don't be completely surprised if you catch one.
What else should we be talking about here? There's other besides salmon.
Well, yeah, of course, in Michigan, trout are a prize fish, and there are some native species and some non-native species of trout in Michigan, but trout are much less migratory. They are quite distinct from salmon that way. And so they may move as the water temperatures change from shallow water or move a little bit in the river basin that they're in, but they're not as migratory, but still famous here in Michigan.
Well, Dr. Atkins, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about fish migration, and you're very broad-minded to go beyond birds.
Well, we tried.
So what other subjects that we might look forward to in the subsequent episodes?
Well, we've talked a lot about migration, which is the movement of the animals, but we really haven't tackled a much more difficult topic of how do they know where to go? And that's the topic we call navigation. So how do they find their way? You know, we use our phone and GPS. How do they do that? And that's what we'd like to cover in a couple more episodes.
Well, listeners, you've been listening to The Nature Guy at his home turf here at Camp Asabo. He's the biologist and the nature guy. And we will be continuing this discussion with navigation. And you can go back into our archives at strongtowerradio.org on audio archives or str.fm and listen to all of The Nature Guy's presentation. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, for Strong Tower Radio. God bless. Bye now.